This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I'll talk a little bit about the concrete problem that started this work, and then I'll talk a little bit about the concepts, and then I'll get into the remedy. That's kind of the general organization. The problem that started is a very simple problem, that the performance of groups whose abilities are negatively stereotyped in certain areas, that those groups performing in those areas tend to do worse than other people in those areas, even when their preparation and their skill level and their talents as measured in other contexts are the same. So that preparation and skill and talent, all those, that bundle of things, doesn't seem to completely guarantee an equal level of performance in areas where, based on one or another of your identities, your abilities are negatively stereotyped. I saw this for the first time when I described this in the book of being on a committee at the University of Michigan on the retention and recruitment of minority students, and there were the grades of Michigan graduates graphed out as a function of the SAT scores they had when they came into Michigan. And what you saw is that kids with higher SAT scores tended to have higher grades, not in a big way, but to a degree. But when you looked at African American students separately, at every level of entering SAT score, their grades were lower than the grades of other students. And that really was provided. Why should that be? My understanding was that if you got preparation and skills and everything, you got those to the same level, then you should get the same level of performance. And that wasn't happening. And it was consistent across the full range of scores. So that was the puzzle. And then we immediately, within weeks, Steve Spencer and I, doing sort of detective work, found that the same thing was true for women in advanced math courses at the University of Michigan. That the same scores, the same prior achievement levels, the same level of commitment to the area, to the work, they weren't doing as well in those advanced math courses as other students, as men, with the same credentials. So why would this be? Was the puzzle. And after many years of struggling around, Brenda certainly was witness to much of this, and Jim. and Brenda's work actually is a big inspiration here. They published a paper in 1988 on stigmatization, Brenda and Jenny Crocker, which just inspired me to believe that you could do good experimental research about this kind of problem, the experience of being on the negative side of some general societal perception of your group, that you could reduce that to things where you could do research on it. So, many years later, we get a concept like stereotype threat. It's, in a sense, developed to explain that underperformance phenomenon that I just described to you. And the idea is very simple, that based on you're trying to perform in an area where your group is seen as not being very good. And that just loads the experience with a level of self-consciousness and anxiety and the like that interferes with your performance there and makes being in that area a relatively onerous experience compared to somebody who's a member of a group not negatively stereotyped in that area or even positively stereotyped in that area, and that the stereotype becomes the precise sort of focus light that projects this negative sense of suspicion over your work. So the definition is very straightforward. Anytime you're in a situation or you're doing something for which a negative stereotype about one of your identities is relevant to that situation, is relevant, that's the key word. The stereotype out there becomes relevant to what you're doing in that situation. You instantly, at some level, usually pre-conscious, know that you could be judged or treated in terms of that stereotype. And if you care about what you're doing, this is the critical part of the recipe for stereotype threat too. If you care about what you're doing, the prospect of being seen or treated in terms of that stereotype is upsetting and distracting and onerous in the sense, in the ways I just talked about it. So it's a very simple thing. It happens to everybody. Maybe certainly a couple times a week, if not more than that, in relation to one identity or another. Every single identity that you could think of has negative stereotypes about it. And when you're in a situation where those negative stereotypes are relevant, and if you care about it, you could experience this form of stereotype threat. So it's a very straightforward definition of the phenomenon I'm talking about. So to illustrate it, I just gave a talk with two former students who are colleagues now, Jeff Cohen and Greg Walton, and they said, "Man, you really gotta get your materials kind of upgraded. You gotta come into out of the cold and into into the modern world." So I have some materials. You're the benefit of this pressure on me. And we were trying to think, well, let's get a member of a person who's going to be under an unusual kind of stereotype threat for people in that group. So let's get a white guy who is going to be under the pressure of a negative stereotype about intellectual ability. Where would that be? What domain would that be?
Dancing.
That's not intellectual enough.
Oh, okay.
Rapping. You're close. You're warm. Greg just happened to have seen a movie I confess I never saw until he told me to see it. The story of Eminem, the white male rapper. And when you see that movie, it's essentially a story about this guy overcoming a stereotype threat. That it's an intensely intellectual activity. But it's one where white guys, as you'll see in this clip, are negatively stereotyped. They're seen as not being able to do that well. It's just not, that's not their thing. So there's a big negative, and yet he cares very much about performing and doing. And as we know, he emerges to be really one of the greatest rappers of all time. I mean, he's got an impressive talent there. So that's what you're going to see here is the beginning of the movie 8 Mile. And he is about to go into an intense contest. And this is a really tough. We rarely have to do intellectual things that are this tough, where you have to, the one rapper, get you flip a coin, one rapper gets to rap first. His job is to insult the other rapper, make all kinds of insults and allegations on the spot, in time, and in rhyme. That's what he has to do. And then the other guy has to field all of that, and in rhyme and in time, he has to parry back, respond back to this. And in the meantime, you got this roaring, chanting crowd, this mood, that's pulsing this this pressure on you. And the accusing rapper can use anything. I mean, no holes barred here. So he uses the white stereotype. Your problem is that you're white with a mic. That's your problem. So you'll see what I mean here, and you'll see the impact it has on him.
Go!
Well, that's the opening scene, and as I say, the rest of the movie is kind of the experiences he goes through that kind of allow him to get past this pressure and to perform.
So he said nothing.
He said nothing. Yeah.
The audience is yelling out, chill, chill, chill.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, first they're kind of, the audience is kind of open, and you know, but they don't know which rapper to side with. They don't know what's going to happen. But then he starts to choke, and they start to yell choke, and the pressure starts to build, and he can't even remember what the other guy said to him by this point, I'm sure. Well, it's a good movie. It's an interesting movie for a lot of reasons, and that's the real Eminem there. And I don't know if you guys know his stuff, but some of it's very good, I can say. But that's a good picture of it. You know, you can imagine a person taking an SAT test under a similar kind of pressure, I suppose, is the analog there. Then that is the next question. Does this kind of pressure go to school? Does it happen in important contexts? You could think that maybe people would be able to when the stakes are higher, to overcome the pressure and perform despite the fact, or that they'd somehow get used to it and it wouldn't be a factor. So the clip that I'm going to show you at this point, this is an ancient one, and I bet a lot of you have seen this. It comes from the blue-eyed, brown-eyed experiment that was done many, many years ago. Jane Elliott, a school teacher in Riceville, Iowa, the day after Martin Luther King is assassinated, wants to come up with some kind of experience for her students that would give them some idea about what the civil rights movement was about, what his Martin Luther King's life was about, why is everybody so concerned, and so on. And so she comes up with this essentially experiment that you could never do in a modern anywhere purposely, intentionally in the modern world, I don't think. She divides the classrooms into blue-eyed kids and brown-eyed kids, and she on one day stigmatizes the brown-eyed kids, and in the next day she stigmatizes the blue-eyed kids. And the camera just follows the expressions and the dynamics in the classroom across the day. So on the first day, and she makes, to make sure kid people you could see their eye color, she makes these little collars, a brown collar. And so the first day they come in, the brown-eyed kids are handed out these collars, and she stands in front of the classrooms and says things like, you know, brown-eyed people are not good people, and brown-eyed people are not smart people, and they should go in the back of the class. And she has them get up and go in the back of the class, and she says they don't smell good, and she just, you know, it's rough stuff. And the camera follows them in the playground and so on. And, you know, they're traumatized. It's traumatic. And the next day, she turns the tables. The brown-eyed kids get to take their collars off, and the blue-eyed kids have to put a collar on. And she says exactly the same thing to the blue-eyed kids that she said to the brown-eyed kids. You see exactly the same kind of reaction. And one of the parts of the, and this of course has been followed up. You can go online and find out what happened to each one of these kids, what kind of an adult they turned out to be. There are replications of this study in prisons and in all kinds of other places. And one of the things that I always noticed at the side, I think a lot of people have, is that there's a little scene where they're working through a problem deck. There's a card deck, and it's got problems on it, and she's seeing how fast they can go through the problem deck. And one day she's working with kids with collars, and another day she's working with kids without collars. And that's what this clip shows.
Three minutes. How long did it take you today?
Four minutes and 18 seconds.
What happened?
One down.
Why? What were you thinking of?
This.
So, I think that's really where our research begins, is trying to see if this threat can actually have, if you look at it carefully, can it have an effect on cognitive performance and cognitive functioning? So we start with the very first experiment that Steve Spencer and I ever did was to look at the experience of women taking a very women and men who are really good math students, by the way, taking a really difficult math test alone in a room. Could that set of minimal conditions evoke something like what we're seeing there? That is a very heavy-handed experiment. That's a very heavy-handed implementation of an identity threat there. You've got a collar on, you've been stigmatized all day, and now you're, but suppose you're talking about an identity that you've had all your life, and you've just kind of wandered into a situation where the society's very general stereotypes about that identity are all of a sudden made relevant by the fact that the test you're taking is frustrating and difficult, and you're a person who really cares about doing well in this domain. Would that set of conditions be enough to have an effect on cognitive functioning? So that's what we did. We just got women and men who are really good at math, told us that math was very important to their careers. They're sophomores at Michigan for the most part. Brought them into a lab one at a time, gave them a very difficult math test. If our reasoning was correct, the idea was that for a woman, this would be a very difficult or a very different situation than it would be for a man. Everything in the physical situation would be the same. The same experimenter, the same pictures on the wall. But social psychologically, this would be very different for a woman than it would be for a man, in that as the woman, as the man begins to perform and it starts to be really hard, they could, because they care about this a lot, they're going to have some anxiety about, well, geez, am I as good as I thought I was, and what is this, and so on. They may well have that kind of a reaction. But the women in that situation would have, because of the society we're in and the stereotypes that are out there about women's math ability, would have this extra explanation of her frustration sort of creep into probably underneath consciousness somewhere and suggest that maybe this frustration on this very difficult math test is because of, you know, what they say isn't part true. It's kind of like the Larry Summers stereotype, that maybe I've reached what they're alleging is true. And since they care a lot about doing well in this situation, they could have a very strong anxiety reaction and get distracted, and their performance could go down. And that's exactly what happened in this situation, even though we had them matched as carefully as we could by prior measures of math ability. The women in that situation scored about a standard deviation on average worse than the men in that situation. That still leaves the two kind of explanations plausible, though. A Larry Summers could emerge and say, well, that's kind of what, you should expect. Because maybe this biological difference in math ability isn't going to manifest itself until you use a really difficult math test like this. And so that's kind of what you got there. So we were quickly informed of this alternative explanation. And it was daunting because it took us probably another year, I would say, to get a good way to separate, a good procedure, experimental procedure, to separate the two accounts of the underperformance. And eventually we came up with a very simple idea. Just before, we did the experiment over again, just the same way, except this time, just before they take the test, we say to all of the subjects, men and women, all of the participants, that, look, you may have heard that women don't do as well on difficult standardized math tests as men. You may have heard that, but that's not true for this particular math test. The test you're taking today is just a test on which women always do as well as men. So the subtext is, on this test, there's nothing you could do that would confirm anything about your being a woman. You could confirm something about your math ability, that maybe you're not as good as you thought you were, but you couldn't confirm that that's true because of something about your being a woman. And so, and this was certainly the most important day in the history of this research, women performed as well as men with that simple instruction, and everything else being the same. You take that pressure out and everything. So that gave us some confidence And, you know, replicating that gave us some confidence that there was something here that might be important. These stereotypes about identities could visit people in situations and have effects. And then Josh Aronson and I looked at this same issue with regard to race. And Brown and Day did a better experiment than we ever did. They gave black and white college students a nonverbal IQ test, the Raven's Progressive Matrices IQ test, which the items of which look like a puzzle. And that was the niceness of this. When they gave them the IQ test, and they didn't say anything about it or let them assume it was an IQ test, a test of cognitive abilities, the black students performed about a standard deviation worse than the white students, which is about the same size of the difference between blacks and whites in the general population in the United States. Same, so we had bottled in the laboratory a difference as comparable to this difference in the broader society. However, when you presented the test as not a test at all, but just as a puzzle, it's a puzzle. Just do what you're going to do. Have fun with it. There was no difference between black and white subjects taking that test. So again, we were, you know, very heartened by this, that this might be a factor. Is it everything? Of course it's not everything. Does it even address the biological interpretation? Not really. But it certainly brings to light a process that can systematically, cumulatively, have some significant impact in a person's life around these important areas of performance. And so, as many of you know, quite fortunately, a lot of people have looked at stereotype threat in a lot of different problems. I like sports, so I like a lot of the stereotype threat sports studies because they kind of show effects that you sort of always sense are there to some degree. You have black and white elite athletes do a golf task in a room, and to put the white athletes under stereotype threat, you tell them that I want you to do the best you can here. This is a test of natural athletic ability. Just want you to do the best you can. So now, as those athletes are performing and experiencing some frustration on that golf task, there is now emerging as relevant a stereotype about their group and what this frustration could be reflecting. And since they care about doing well, that combination of ingredients, that combination of elements is distracting and upsetting, and their performance goes down. But you can reduce, you can flip the results by just saying, just before the white and the black athletes do exactly the same task, you can say this time, well, this, you do the best you can, this is a test of sports strategic intelligence. Then the other group is under a negative stereotype, and so blacks now underperform in relation to whites on that golf task. So, in a variety of ways, I think one area of stereotype threat effects that are important and that haven't been developed, I suppose, as much as they might be, is on its effect on our relationships with each other, our cross-group relationships with each other. It's often when we come into contact with different groups that different forms of stereotype threat, I think, become really big forces in those interactions and can have an effect on them. This is one form of stereotype threat that I think the white experience of stereotype threat in an interracial interaction can be an incredibly intense kind of thing. And you would you might interpret that as due to something else, as due to prejudice or due to something, you know, there's so much in the lay psychology about the nature of that. But it could be much more of this sort of stereotype shadowing us in these situations. So, you know, Phil Goff and I did a very simple experiment of having white males come into the room and they were expecting to have a conversation with two other students, and they see the photographs of the two students, and in one case they find out they're going to have a conversation with two black guys, in the other case they're going to have a conversation with two white guys. And then they find out that the conversation is going to be either about something kind of racially relevant or not racially relevant. It's going to be about love and relationships, not racially relevant. Or it's going to be about racial profiling. So they're expecting to talk about to two white guys or two black guys about either racial profiling or about love and relationships. That's the setup. And then the experimenter says to them, look, I'm going to go down the hall and I'm going to get your conversation partners and bring them back. While I'm gone, would you arrange the chairs for this conversation? And of course, as soon as they arrange the chairs for the conversation, the experiment's essentially over. You're looking to see how people handle that upcoming situation. And you can predict, as well as we could, what happened, which is that when they're going to talk to two white guys about anything, they put the three chairs pretty close together. When they're going to talk to two black guys about love and relationships, they put the three chairs pretty close together. But when they're going to talk to two black guys about racial profiling, they put themselves here and the two black guys over here. They put a real distance there. And this is the sort of interesting thing. We had various measures of prejudice on these participants before this experiment. And so we could correlate in that condition who put the chairs the farthest away. Was it the least prejudiced of the subjects or was it the most prejudiced of the subjects? I'm going to say I think the lay psychology would suggest that it's the most prejudiced subjects that would distance themselves the most in that situation, but it's the least. And it's because the least probably feel that there's the most to lose in this conversation if it should go awry. You can't control it completely. It's a really loaded topic. And if I were to have this conversation and something went wrong and that person were to judge me as, you know, a racist or racially insensitive or something, that would be very upsetting. Very upsetting. So that's what they're protecting themselves against by putting this distance between themselves and the conversation partner. They're handling a stereotype threat in that situation. They're not expressing an internalized deep prejudice toward the person. And you can be as good a judge as I can about how much of the racial sort of tension between groups is attributable to one thing or the other thing. I think the stereotypes hover around. This is how history, in a sense, visits us in contemporary life. And I think this experiment sort of gives an illustration of the role it probably plays. I think in a lot of circumstances, a lot of schooling circumstances, which is an area that I'm increasingly immersed in, this is more what the issue. These kind of tensions, what will people think if this interaction goes wrong? What's available for people to think if this interaction goes wrong is more what is driving people's behavior and emotion in a situation than anything like a deeply internalized prejudice. I'm not saying for a minute that I think that's off the table, because it's not, of course. But this other factor is, I think, an important ripple in the story that we have to understand. Well, we know now that a lot of things happen to people who are under stereotype threat. There's all kinds of physiological reactions, accelerated heart rate, galvanic skin response. There are certain patterns of brain activity that seem to correspond with being under stereotype threat in high-pressured situations. So there's a lot going on. But interestingly, and this has been true since the very beginning in this area of research, Jim and I did a study on this, was the first one, people aren't able to report it very well. They don't have a conscious sense of being under that kind of a threat. So when you ask them how anxious they are, they often say, no, I'm not very, you know, I feel fine. I know how to deal with these situations. I can remember Josh and I interviewing subjects right away, and they were surprisingly cool and calm. We knew that they'd been under this pressure. We could see the physiological evidence. We could see that they performed terribly. But they had a subjective sense of being kind of in control of the situation. They felt like they knew what to do. So we don't enjoy a great deal of access to this experience. So one question is, well, what makes stereotype threat stronger and a bigger problem, and what makes it weaker and a lesser problem, and you know that kind of an analysis might lead to remedies and what to do about it. Well, there's one other thing I want to stress about it, and this didn't really get developed in my thinking until I tried to write about it like at a book length kind of a project, and that is the chronicity of it. There are certain forms of it that are almost laughable. They're kind of just not of any great, real great significance. And then there are other forms of it that, because they happen to you and happen to people in very important domains of life, are very intense and haunting. Go on forever, and you can't really beat the thing in the sense that you can't like behave a certain way or achieve a certain thing and have that end the possibility that you'd ever be stereotyped by that stereotype again. There's always you going into another situation and maybe encountering another time. So it becomes a kind of constant feature of a person's life, and I have a videotape here, which is of Charles Blow being interviewed by Bill Maher. And Charles Blow is the African-American editorialist for the New York Times. He writes that Saturday column, which usually has a graphic in it. He's talking about his reaction to the Trayvon Martin situation. And it's kind of an interesting expression of this feature of this threat.
Have to watch. I mean, it's almost exhausting.
You can't wear a hoodie.
Well, not only can you not wear a hoodie, but you literally are consciously paying attention to the way you move your body.
Right.
It is a physically exhausting exercise to know I can't run or make a sudden movement because now I see some cop standing on the corner and he's looking this way. Or I can't put my hands in my waistband, as George Zimmerman says that Trayvon Martin had his hands in his waistband, because that may signal that I have some sort of weapon. This kind of constant having to think about how you are positioning your body so that no one takes advantage of that and views you as suspicious and maybe takes your life or takes you to jail is exhausting.
Actually, the other African-American editorialist for the New York Times is named Brent Staples. And when he was a graduate student in psychology at the University of Chicago, and walking down the streets of Hyde Park, he realized that this big guy dressed like a student, that he was making whites feel uncomfortable. And they wouldn't maintain eye contact, and they crossed the street, and it bothered him. He writes about this in his autobiography, Parallel Time. Incidental reasons, he tries to become a whistler, and he starts going down the street whistling Beatles tunes and Vivaldi. And when he does that, everybody like relaxes, and they say, "Hey, how you doing?" And it's a completely different thing, because he's now a different person. It's just a perfect story of how people, without much awareness, we kind of whistle Vivaldi an awful lot to deflect ourselves being seen by a given stereotype. And you know, I could just go down a stereotype about our sex, our gender, I guess those are very related, our race, our age, our region of the country, there's a thousand things, our social class status, there are all kinds of things. So that's why I think it happens so much in our lives, is that there's so many identities with negative stereotypes. We're so often in circumstances where they could be applied to us, and we so often do things like deflect them, that it's pretty a common experience, I think, to everybody. But you can see when it's around very important things, and the stereotypes are focused in very important domains, and they persist. You can't really get out of it. It can start to become a factor that would affect whether you'd even want to go into a domain where you have to deal with that level of discomfort, like, say, women in quantitatively based fields, and that you'd want to persist in that domain for a very long period of time, because you just are part of your cognitive resources are being allocated to deal with the possibility of this perception of you. So that is where I think the thing gets, like Charles Blow describes, a kind of chronic burden of life, not something that just passes through, like the experiments could apply that they just happen and go away. But this starts to be a real condition of life, a condition of having a given identity at a particular time in a particular society. You might get on a plane and fly to another society, as I talk about in the book, where they have a completely different set of understandings of these, and you wouldn't have that problem at all. It's so situational. But you come back and you put yourself back in that same situation, and the stereotype again becomes you're back into that, into the grip of it again. What makes it bad? Our first impulse was lack of confidence. We're a psychologist. That's where we would go first, to something inside the head. Lower self-esteem, maybe a bad sense about one's identity group, a variety of things like that seem to be the candidates. These are the major candidates in explaining the experience of stigmatized groups throughout the 20th century. There's sort of a standing story that these kind of stereotypes cause a psychic damage of some sort. Oftentimes, they appropriate a Robert Merton term. There's a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's an internalization that happens, and then that is triggered in certain situations, and you get an underperformance as a function of that. And so, as psychologists, you can't just walk by that. You have to give that some attention. But the reason we were quickly deterred is that you can only get the effects that I've just described among the members of the stereotype group who were the strongest and the most committed in the area of the of the stigmatized performance. So it didn't happen for women who didn't care about math or defined their lives and identified with something else. Stereotype effects didn't happen there. It happened with the women who were really good at math, had been good at math for a long time and wanted to be good at math. It's for them, those people who really, the prospect of being stereotyped like that is upsetting and disturbing. So that's the ingredient. You have to want to do this, and to want to do this, you probably had to be pretty good at it. So we looked at African-American students in the inner city who were pretty disidentified with school, no effective stereotype threat. But you look in the same school, the African-American students who were really identified with school, and you see big stereotype threat effects. So that made it clear that it probably wasn't the standard set of explanations that drove the strength of this effect. And our best guess is that it is the strength of cues in the outside situation, in the situation the person is in. And here the Sandra Day O'Connor story that I use in the book is a good example, because it's sort of outside of the whole schooling thing. But it just is a powerful illustration of how the context can affect the degree of stereotype threat you feel. She's being interviewed on the radio by Nina Totenberg about her autobiography. At one point, Totenberg asked her, what was it like for you to be the first woman on the Supreme Court? And without any hesitation, she says, it was asphyxiating. It was just asphyxiating. Everywhere I went, the press followed me. They talked about how smart I was, how wise I was, whether I was a feminist, whether I was too feminist. They could just say anything about me. I'd never been through something like that before. It was just traumatizing. And then Totenberg says, well, what happened when Ruth Bader Ginsburg got on the Supreme Court? And she says, oh, it was like night and day. All of a sudden, there were two women on the Supreme Court. And the reporters stopped following me around. They're stopping all this speculation about me in particular and how smart I was and wise I was and all that. It all went away. We just very quickly got to be two normal justices on the Supreme Court. Then Sandra Day O'Connor leaves the Supreme Court, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg starts to experience the pain of this and says at a couple of points, like, I just don't want it to be the case that a woman on the Supreme Court is something abnormal. I don't want it to be something abnormal. So here's a case where just another woman in the environment, that critical mass, if I can use that term, makes a huge difference. In a concrete difference, this isn't some kind of mystical thing. She's treated and responded to very differently when she's the only woman on the Supreme Court compared to when she is on the Supreme Court with two women there. The whole set of contingencies tied to that identity are very different as a function of the situation, of the cues in the situation. Well, as I say in the book, I heard this interview about a month before the Supreme Court was going to announce its decision on the affirmative action case. A month later, they did. And she was the deciding justice in that case. And I felt I knew how the case was going to go because the Michigan's defense of its use, the University of Michigan defended the use of affirmative action in higher education, and their defense was based on the idea that on critical mass, that you couldn't, you had to have a certain number of minorities in a university, otherwise the identity pressures. They didn't say it quite like I would say it, but they said it in effect the same way, that the identity pressures would be so intense that they'd just be distracted all the time dealing with that, and that wouldn't be a fair playing field. And so you had to be able to use this policy in this sort of transitional era in American history to do this. And I felt I knew a month beforehand that how this decision was going to go, because as the deciding justice in the decision, Sandra Day O'Connor knew what critical mass was. She knew. She'd been on the court without it, and she'd been on the court with it, and she knew that it made a difference. And if you've seen that, then you can give it some weight. If you haven't seen that, you haven't recognized it, it's hard to give it a weight. It sounds weird, and it sounds like an abstract, excuse-making kind of strategy. But if you've seen it, you'd know it. So that's what I mean by cues in a situation. That's a good example of a cue in a situation is just the critical mass, the number of other people in our experiments. That's one thing that everybody does. When you wind up being on the basis of some identity, a small minority in a situation, everybody starts to count. How many more of there are there like me? You know, how many older people are in this situation right now? And how many younger? You know, you start to do this kind of inherent calculation. Why are you doing the calculation? You're sort of trying to assess and add up the degree to which this identity could be problematic in this situation. Could present you with things that have to be managed in the situation. And at the same time, you might have no real subjective awareness of it. I had a conversation with a woman scientist that were on a board together just this summer, and she said, "Well, you know, I've heard about stereotypes. You know, I know that concept, but you know, stereotypes have really never bothered me. Even when I was young, when I would hear that, you know, I would just work harder, and I just outperform that. So here's a person whose whole life has been spent dealing with it at some level, but has no subjective awareness that's what, in part, what was going on. I'm not reducing a person to just that, but she spent her whole life dealing with that. It's such a chronic adaptation, such a chronic feature of her functioning. And yet really wouldn't have a sense, because what you're trying to buy by coping with it is a sense that problem's out of your life. You've defeated it. You've got a strategy. The problem's gone. You're not going to experience it anymore. But her whole life has been that kind of story. So into the remedy zone. I think I kind of divide them up into three ways. The arguments I'm just talking about, cues, you can see that's going to be a big part of what I think are critical in remedying it. Affecting the cues in a situation, we have some control over that, so that can sometimes help. But I don't want to forget the fact that one maybe primary kind of remedy is to remove the contingencies that are tied to these identities that spawn stereotypes and spawn these pressures. That there are the way society is organized. I start the book by describing my own experience, or the memory of my experience, for whatever that's worth. The memory of my experience of first becoming aware I was black, and when I was a little kid coming home from school, and it's the last day of school. We're talking about what we're going to do in the summer, and all of us are black kids, and we start to speak, well, we can't go to that swimming pool over there. And I can remember that question just stopped everybody. We can't go to that swimming pool except on Wednesday afternoons. It was about three blocks over in the white neighborhood. This is Chicago. And just a lifetime of questions opens up. You know, who is we and who is they, and why? What about that pool and who's? Why on earth would? And only, you know, just all kinds of questions. So you know that the world is organized in such a way as to make this identity threat significant to you. You don't know why, but all of a sudden this part of you, this particular part, is important because you got to deal with things because you got the identity. Stereotypes are just a more abstract kind of contingency. You have to, in certain situations, deal with the prospect of being seen in a given way. That's another contingency. So the first line of remedy, I think, is to rearrange society so we don't have so many damn bad contingencies tied to our various identities. Get rid of all these segregations, for example. Water fountain segregations, you know, swimming pools. Get that out. Thank goodness we've gotten rid of a lot of that stuff. You know, gay marriage you could think of as an example of a contingency tied to an identity that you have to deal with now, and that we have an opportunity to make a choice about this. Now we're going to eventually soon have some opportunity to make a choice about that. So it's a huge contingency that has huge implications about identity, makes an identity incredibly central in a person's life. And so getting rid of some of these contingencies is the first thing you should do. The second tier of things you can do are changing the cues in a situation. Critical mass is a good example of that. Role models are a good examples of that. Existence proof. There's all this talk about, well, does the fact that the president of the United States is an African American make a difference? Yeah, it doesn't upend the racial organization of American society that's been produced by, you know, I don't know, 400 plus years of history. It doesn't undo that, but it does make a difference. Because you're now, as an African American, in a society where an African American can be the president, as opposed to being in a society where you can't be the president. That says something. That makes that identity significant. So that's a big deal. Role models do, I think, make a significant difference in terms of this logic. Diversity. It's such a loaded and fatiguing term. Excuse me, I feel like I'm preaching in the church. Pass the plate back there, will you? Well, I believe diversity is essential to excellence. I know that sounds rhetorical. I know that. But I really believe it. I don't believe... I remember having this image being provost, big university. I actually wondered about work groups, even in the most arcane of sciences, that are completely homogeneous. After a while, you start to wonder, is there enough perspectives in there to really be, to have excellence, to really, we have depended as a society on, we have benefited by having, maybe more than any society in the history of the world, input from everybody around the world, this is an immigrant society. We have benefited from that. That is diversity, and that's what I think is connected to excellence, is having different perspectives available to you. That's as critical as having a slight increment in skill level in a particular work group, for example. The having different perspectives can sometimes advance our understanding faster and better than having people who do the same thing a little better. And so I think diversity has to be recognized as a real source of excellence and a necessity of excellence at some point. And I think that kind of a framework for running a school or whatever is a welcoming framework that reduces these kind of pressures in a situation. It's a framework, an ideology, if you will, that is, I think, an almost honest recognition of the way American society has really worked that welcomes a variety of perspectives and people in it. And so I think that can reduce, that kind of a point of view can reduce the sense of these threats. Lastly, and I'll stop after this, sometimes you just can't do anything that will do it. I used the story of visiting a former student at a Silicon Valley startup firm, and I go in and he introduces me to the CEO, who's 26, and everybody else in there is younger than that. And I'm feeling really old now, and about 5 minutes into this. And there are cues all around the environment. You know, there are dogs walking in the office, like dogs in the office. What's that? And there's music I've never heard this music before. And you know, just the way they relate to each other, and the dress, and the bicycles hanging over their cubicles, and if I had to work there as a software writer, as an old guy like me. you could imagine that identity would start to be a real problem. I'd start to wonder, you know, are they going to ever trust that somebody born so far outside the digital age, so far before the digital age, could ever be a good software writer? And why didn't that guy return my phone call? And they had a party last week, and I didn't even know about it till it was over. And you're sorting through things. And if another old guy comes into the firm, you know, we sit together at the table at lunch and we parse all these things and we comb through this for what's really going on here in this situation. What does this identity mean here? But I couldn't go in with my lawyer if I've got a job there and say, this is a hostile workplace. And you've got to get these bicycles off these hooks and get the dogs out of here, and you got to put some of my music. You couldn't do that. So you need, there are times when I think you need a psychological buffer or strategy for dealing with the threat. I use my, in the book, again, my experience in graduate school this way, and I think it does have a sort of simple elegance to it. It was certainly like that for me going to graduate school in the time I went to began graduate school in 1967. And I was the only African-American there, and this was the days when psychology was completely preoccupied with the genetic interpretation of racial differences in IQ, and there was a faculty member down the hall that would use the N-word, and graduate school itself is all about how smart you are. No, I mean how really, really smart you are. So all that comes together to be, and it was painful. I talk about, you know, sort of having a personality in lockdown in that situation. I just couldn't talk. I just couldn't participate very, very well. And then my advisor, Tom Ostrom, I've suspected he was definitely coming up for tenure at the time. I was his only graduate student, so for those reasons, he might have been shoved into believing in me, but he did believe in me, and I could see that he believed in me, that he took me seriously as somebody that he could talk to. And he'd put his head in the door and he'd ask me how the data were going, and then we'd turn hypotheses over, and I just ate that up. I thought that was fantastic, and I worked really hard, and we got some things done, and then we got a paper published. And when we got the paper published, it was like, wow. It's that way for everybody, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows. Getting a hold on something really makes a huge difference. But in that situation, it was just really a wonderful experience. And then something kind of happened, which was that all of those other cues in the environment that had up to that point been kind of menacing cues and it had me in lockdown, they just didn't seem so important. They just didn't. There was room for me. I could function. I could do this. There was room for me in this situation. I wasn't going to cure the world of racism or something, but there was room for me in this situation. And I had some sense that it was going to be roughly fair. And I think that's what some of the interventions to reduce stereotype threat do, like the one you do, when you give somebody an affirmation and it has a big effect on their school performance. It seems like magic. How could you allow someone for just a few minutes talk about what's really important to them in life and give them a chance to sort of affirm that sense of themselves? How could that affect their performance in school, as it seems to do? Well, I think the way it affects their performance in school is just like my experience with the publication. It kind of affirms that you can do this, that this is a place where you can belong, where you can be comfortable in some sense. And you can be you there. You don't have to transform yourself into something else to be there. You can sort of be who you are there and be of some value. And when you have that kind of perception, the cues just don't have the same ring and power to them that they would otherwise have in the environment. And you can relax and you have now more attention to allocate to the task at hand, and you can do better. And once you do better, that reinforces that sense that you can belong there and function in that situation. I think that this research is sort of tapping into a process that we all go through in joining a profession, for example. I suppose that's a good example of it, is getting a sense that we can thrive in that at least survive and function in that kind of profession. And once you have that, then things that would otherwise, before that question is resolved, things that would otherwise be very upsetting, stop being so upsetting. It's not like you go into a false consciousness state where you're never aware of that. That's not true. But you do have a sense of comfort there. You know, one of the studies that I'll, since it's published and out there, I'll just describe it and end with this, is the Walton and Cohen experiment done at Yale, where for freshmen, black and white freshmen, they look they see the results of a survey of seniors at Yale, and the results of the survey convey a kind of narrative to the subject looking at these survey results. And the narrative is something like this, that, well, you know, you might feel uncomfortable at Yale at the beginning, like maybe you don't belong. And that might make you feel kind of upset. You might want to go home on the weekends and so on. But what you're going to find out is that you're probably going to find a course or so that is really interesting to you and that's going to offer a life course for you. And then you're going to start to feel that Yale is like really a gift, and it's exciting, and it's so fortunate to be here, and that you will be able to kind of find a direction for your life to take in this experience. That's what this offers you here, and it's an exceptionally rich place. And So it's a narrative that they get from these survey results that begins by acknowledging the kind of identity anxiety that they might have as they come into that school. It's not just in your mind. There really could be some anxiety around that. But there are going to be these experiences which make this an incredibly valuable experience for you, and this is going to be a very rich environment, and you're going to see that. Now, if I all of a sudden have that as my narrative about the situation I'm in, then again, the cues in the situation that would otherwise maybe be upsetting are not so upsetting. And I think a lot of interventions that can do that, particular strategies of intervention, can help people have that kind of narrative about the circumstance they're in. In graduate school, what happened to me was just a set of experiences, and you could probably see this in your own lives, a set of experiences that changed your narrative about what was possible for you in a given field. That at a certain point, you know, it's really quite, do I belong here? Can I do this? Is this for me? And without the answer to those questions, the narrative just sort of grinds and, you know, sparks and carries on. But then some experiences start to happen where then it gets resolved and you feel like, yeah, I can do that. And if you're told that at the outset, that's a very different framing for your experience, and it can help you deal with situations where the threats are going to be there. And they're very difficult to control, but probably the only strategy available is developing some fundamental understanding narrative about you, about yourself and the situation that enables you to function there. I'm overdue. I'll stop. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.